Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha.
So what do you do when you thought you understood your past, or even thought you understood yourself, if the things that led you to think that can't be trusted? And I don't know, I think it's a kind of reckoning that most, I guess, thoughtful human beings probably come around to, you know, you asking these questions of what has it all been for?
Carl Phillips is a celebrated poet who has won many awards for his work. Last year, he won the Pulitzer Prize. He also recently retired from Washington University, where he taught for 30 years. He has been busy since then, and his new collection, called Scattered Snows to the North, is out now. The book includes poems about memory, sex, and the natural world. St. Louis Public Radio Arts and Culture senior reporter Jeremy Goodwin recently talked with Phillips. Here's Jeremy.
Since we last spoke, you received a notable distinction, right? Can you tell me about how does somebody learn that they won the Pulitzer Prize?
I came home from day drinking because it was Truman Day in St. Louis, which, as you know, a lot of people have the day off, or government workers have the day off. And we decided to go day drinking on a Monday. And when I came home, I happened to look at Twitter, which I had not looked at in hours. And I saw an announcement. Well, I saw all these people congratulating me. And then I saw that Twitter had made an announcement about the Pulitzer Prize. So I went downstairs and told my partner, I think I've won the Pulitzer Prize. And he asked what I was going to do. And I said, you know, I think I'm going to walk the dog. And then as I walked the dog, I was checking Twitter. And it turned out to be true. I wasn't sure if it was some kind of hoax.
Yeah. So does one know that you're a finalist heading into that? Or does that come completely out of nowhere?
It comes out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a surprise to everyone.
Well, you know, we like to talk about how we're not doing the work for the recognition, but that kind of recognition, what did that mean to you?
You know, it's very gratifying. I've been doing this for a long time, so for me it was more like a nice confirmation that other people, at least five judges, feel like what I've been doing matters. I think we never, no matter how old or experienced we are, we always appreciate some kind of validation. Even though that's not why we're doing it, it still feels good.
Yeah, and I wonder, did you hear a lot of support from your peers in academia, or is it so competitive, you know, you found shaving cream in your coat pocket in the faculty lunchroom or something?
No, everyone was at WashU, everyone was very excited and supportive. And, you know, there's a tradition in the writing program at WashU of faculty having won the Pulitzer, but that hadn't happened in many decades. So I think people were just very excited for me. I don't know, maybe some people go into poetry as competition, but I think we're all just trying to wrestle with our own demons and just doing it the only way we know how.
Well, I wonder, when you sit down and write again after that kind of recognition, is it in your head at all? Is it something you're thinking about? I am now a Pulitzer Prize winning poet. What am I going to do?
No, but maybe because I don't, when I go to poems, it's a very private space, and I'm not even aware of an audience at all, except some alternative part of myself, I guess. I mean, I think the only time that I became more conscious of it was when this new book now was in production. I was aware that, oh, this is the first book that I've published since that prize. So I didn't know if there'd be more scrutiny or something. But I turned in the manuscript for this new book before I ever knew of that prize.
Ah, gotcha. And it's just interesting for you to say that you're not thinking about an audience when you write. Who are you writing for?
I think I'm just writing to try to pin down things in myself that I always think I've vanquished, and then they rise up again. I think we all have things that we're always wrestling with, and fears and desires. And I find that writing lays those things to rest for a while until they rouse up again. And that seems to be the incentive for the next poem. So for me, that's not something where I'm thinking of other people. I'm really just trying to have a private encounter with my own interiority, I suppose.
Is that a change at all from when you've spoken in the past about a poem as a form of control or a seduction of the reader? That sounds a little more like an engagement with what the response is going to be.
Yeah, they're related, because I'm not writing and thinking, oh, I need to seduce the reader. But I do feel that what a poem is meant to do is attract a reader's attention and sustain it. So I suppose once I get to revising the poem, I'm thinking in those terms. Is this a good entry point? Would I want to read further if I read this first line? Is this poem too long, or does it end too soon? So then I'm aware of those things, because I want to know if it's something I need to make public or not.
Kat, would you share something with us from the book?
Okay, this is called Regime. As I took off my clothes, I watched him taking his own off. The sound of rain was, for once, not the sound of wind shaking the rain steadily loose from a stand of river birch. It's hard to believe in them, the beautiful colors of extinction. But these are the colors.
That is, it's the first in the book, and you also chose that as one you wanted to share. Why does it start the book, and why do you feel comfortable reading it?
Well, it starts the book because it introduces, I think, a few ideas. It has one sentence that's about two people taking their clothes off, so probably sex is in the near future. And then there's the idea of weather and what's going on in the natural world. And then what seems like a weird statement, that it's hard to believe in the colors of extinction, but these are the colors. And I was interested in this idea that no matter what we're doing, like if we're looking around, what are the signs of extinction? We're living it now. And even when we're taking our clothes off, even when we're listening to the weather outside, it's all ongoing extinction. At least that's what I believe. And so I think the poem introduces the idea of mortality always being present, even in our most sort of alive moments, including the alive moment of sex and the alive moment of the weather passing through the natural world. I guess maybe thematically it opens with those ideas that I guess are pursued in the book. And I guess that's why I wanted to read it. I also think that because I am sort of known for these long, convoluted sentences, this poem actually has pretty straightforward ones. And I like this, the cleanness of that, that I kind of showed myself that I could write more simplistically or straightforwardly if I wanted to.
When I see a phrase, the beautiful colors of extinction, I don't want to make the magician share how he does all his tricks, but is that a phrase that comes into your mind and you hold on to it for a while until you find the right home for it?
Yeah, that's an example of something that probably came to me while I was walking the dog, and I wrote it into the notes section of my phone and thought, huh. Because what I like about it is the idea that how can extinction have beautiful colors? Isn't extinction a terrible thing? But, you know, we've seen photographs of beautiful skyscapes, and then we'll learn that, oh, the reason it's beautiful is because of the pollution level over the city or something, and it's creating wonderful light effects or something. So it's interesting how what is a terrible thing happening can sometimes lead to strange beauty at the same time.
And the title regime, that also leaves the reader with a lot to think about and suggests maybe even something, a political connotation of some sort here.
Yeah, and titles are hard for me to come up with, but when I came up with this one, it seemed right and I didn't know why. But the more I've thought about it, the more I think, well, sometimes I feel like we're living increasingly in a regime. But even that is interesting because within the regime of political struggle and upheaval and violence, people are still doing simple things like taking their clothes off so they can have sex. The wind is still blowing and rain is still lashing at the window. And so even in those very political times, not every moment feels political. So it's kind of like, what else is going on? When I see the word regime, I immediately think of political power, but meanwhile, they're individual people having their private interior lives.
Do you feel when you complete something, and let's include the revision process and the editing, but do you have a sense when something is really working, when you really did what you were trying to do?
Well, yes. I mean, I guess the only poems I keep are the ones where I think, oh, something's really working here. I don't go into poems thinking, here's what I want to do. I go into poems to kind of get lost and sort out. I try to find my way out of something through language. But what will happen at some point, I'll realize I've surprised myself. I've done something that I didn't expect, or I've said something that I didn't know I felt. And that's when I realize, okay, now you're actually writing a poem. You're not following a path. You're making one. But that doesn't always happen every time I sit down to write. But the ones where it does happen, those are the poems that end up in a book.
You're a poet of the page, it seems to me. And it seems that you want to use everything that the page offers you. Line breaks, punctuation, the titles of poems tend to be significant, the way words are arranged on the page. You seem to revel in the language of it.
Yes, I think, I think why would you write poems if you didn't love language? And I am excited at the idea of using language in ways that might be new or surprising to others.
Well, you've had a long relationship with sentences, right? I think you love sentences and delaying the idea that might be coming. Sometimes reading your work, it seems to be nodding toward a certain meaning, and then that meaning escapes because it curls back in a different direction. And this is drama that happens as the eye goes from left to right on the page.
I'm glad it comes across that way. Yeah, I think of sentences as thought. They're kind of thought laid out. And I'm interested in trying to pursue this thing that I know doesn't exist, the truth. And so I feel like it seems honest to move in one direction and then realize you need to revise your steps. You have to retrace your steps sometimes. I like the idea of the sentence enacting that.
Well, can we talk a bit about the new book, Scattered Snows to the North? Is it possible to say there's any particular theme or conceit at work here?
Sure, I guess. I mean, some of it I don't really write in terms of books and themes, but I've learned from other people who have written about it that there's a lot that is about memory and the degree to which memory can and cannot be trusted the older we get. But also, not just because of age, but because of the nature of memory. I used to think that if we remembered something, that's a way of holding on to the truth. And then I have learned that it's possible for three people to remember the exact same thing differently and to believe each of their experiences is the truth. So what do you do with that? So there's that, and maybe a theme, a bit of mortality, but I think that's just natural from getting older, and how one thinks about the world at 30 is different at 60. It sounds kind of gloomy as a theme, but I think it's just looking at those elements of being a human being and getting older on Earth.
There's a description of the book in the materials. I don't know if this comes from your pen specifically, but I imagine you approved it. It says, if the poet's last few books have concerned themselves with power, this one focuses on vulnerability. How do we see that in these pieces?
Well, I think because in earlier books, I make a lot of assertions and with this assumption that it is possible to have, for there to be something like truth, and all you have to do is come into possession of it. And I think one of the most vulnerable things about this new book is realizing that there is no fixed truth, and you can't trust memory. So what do you do when you thought you understood your past, or even thought you understood yourself, if the things that led you to think that can't be trusted? And I don't know, I think it's a kind of reckoning that most, I guess, thoughtful human beings probably come around to. You know, you get to an age where you've lived long enough to regret choices you made, or to have experienced loss of different kinds. And we start sort of asking these questions of what has it all been for? And what is it still for? So to me, those leave one in a very vulnerable position.
And in reading these poems, the idea of engaging with memory clearly is in there, reconsidering the present moment, past moments. But these poems also are definitely happening in the physical world. There's a real tactile sense to a lot of them. I started underlining just about every poem has either a reference to water or trees or a leaf or some weather event happening. How does that interact with all your thought processes here?
Well, I think the things in one's head are abstractions. And so what's necessary to counterbalance those is concreteness. And I think that might be why I'm always sort of weighing in and with physical space. You know, you can't really live inside freedom or fear or betrayal. But you can hold on to a tree. You can swim in the ocean. And I think that the natural world maybe appears because I think we're not just intellectual beings. We're physical beings. And so we're physical beings with a body, and a body that interacts in a physical way with the physical world around us, even as we're having these thoughts in our head. So to me, it's always just seemed natural that, of course, you describe the world around you as you're thinking. One of the things I have said to my students for years is that poetry is world building. Each poem, you build a world that you want to convince the reader is believable, that this could actually be a world that exists. And so to do that, you have to populate it with things like trees or animals or whatever world you're trying to conjure.
That's Washington University Professor Emeritus and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Carl Phillips speaking with STLPR's Jeremy Goodwin. After a short break, we'll return to their conversation about Phillips' new book, Scattered Snows to the North. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. Let's return to STLPR Arts and Culture Senior Reporter Jeremy Goodwin's conversation with poet Carl Phillips. Phillips won the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry last year and retired from WashU this past spring after teaching there for 30 years. This next part of their conversation starts with Phillips reading a poem from his new book, this one titled Before All This.
And as usual, early summer seems already to hold inside it the split fruit of late fall, those afternoons whose diminished music will soon enough lie down in, surprised a little to feel at all surprised. Meanwhile, how the wind sometimes makes the slenderest trees still young bend over makes me think of knowledge conquering superstition. I can almost believe in that until the trees, like fear, spring back. then a sad sort of quiet just after, as between two people who have finally realized they've stopped regretting the same things. It's like they've never known each other. Yet even now, waking, they insist they've woken from a dream they share, forgetting all over again that every dream is private. Whatever the reasons are for the dead underbranches of the trees that flourish here, that the dead persist is enough. For me, it's enough. The air stirs like history, like the future, like history.
Looking at that poem, one of the things that's interesting is we see nature almost thwarting a sense of human virtue. The idea that a tree being bent over and coming close to snapping is like knowledge conquering superstition. And when the tree recovers, it does so because fear recovers. It's an interesting way to maybe externalize a thought process in what you're seeing in the landscape.
Yeah, I think one of the things I dislike about being a poet is that perfectly ordinary things happen, and we tend to then make them mean something, even though I don't think they always do mean anything. So, you know, most people would look at a tree blowing in the wind and say, okay, that's what it is. But a poet will sit there and say, oh, that tree reminds me of my mind and how it's tossing in the various thoughts or something. So we tend to turn ordinary concrete things into something abstract. I think precisely because we don't know how to describe abstract things. And so I don't know. For me, that was like my version of a sense of humor in that poem, where I think it's funny that these are just trees bending around. It's just the speaker who wants to make them mean something more than what they are.
Well, the battle of knowledge conquering superstition and fear being resilient is probably a dynamic that looks familiar to a lot of people right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting how that can happen. You're just writing something privately, but it resonates in ways that you don't expect with other people.
Somewhere There's Still Summer is the title of that section. And this sense of loss is maybe not here yet, but it's sort of accumulating on the border. There's a lateness to things.
Yeah. Well, because that's how I think of autumn and late summer. I mean, late summer to me is obviously, it sort of suggests that autumn is nearby, and autumn implies winter, and we associate winter with death, and even though it's not entirely about death. So I've always been interested in seasons and how we're programmed. We're seasonal beings ourselves.
You've also had another big life change in the past couple of years and since we've last spoke, and that is you retired from Washington University. And are you still in St. Louis?
No, I retired 2 months ago and moved almost immediately, to everyone's shock, back to Massachusetts, where I'm from. And it was a quick exit, but no reflection on St. Louis or the university. First of all, I wanted to leave before anyone could make a fuss. And I don't like parties and being the focus of celebrations. So it seemed nice to just disappear. I think people act surprised about the whole retirement thing. I think because in academia, so few people retire, it seems, before 70, sometimes before 80. Many of my colleagues who are still there are older than I am. It's an easy job to stay in and be old. But I myself always knew I was going to retire at 65 if I could afford it. And I know that's not possible for a lot of people nowadays, but fortunately I was able to. So, and I also think it's important because there are a lot of, I want to say young poets, but at this point they're middle-aged poets who are trying to get jobs in academia. And one of the main reasons they can't is because no one is retiring.
As an outsider looking at sort of the timeline of your life and career, it seems like there have been a few very big shifts. You were a teacher, a high school teacher in Massachusetts, started experiencing some success with poetry, had a lot of acclaim for your first collection, and then found this position in Washington University, which was originally meant to be 3 years. And then what, three decades went by? Did that happen in a flash?
It feels like it sometimes. I mean, I don't feel like I've been in St. Louis for 30 years, and it's very strange. I had no intention of being in St. Louis for so long, specifically because the job wouldn't have allowed me to stay. And but I found that when I did have opportunities to leave, WashU was very competitive in counter offers, and also it was a very good place, supportive place to get writing done, and so I didn't want to leave anymore. And I think it was a very successful time. I lucked out getting that job.
I think that when we move somewhere different, we often begin to understand the place that we came from in a different way. What does St. Louis look like to you now?
Well, I mean, it's only been a couple months since I left. But it's strange because in some ways I feel now, where I live now is, I'm surrounded by trees. I sort of live in a forest that's a foresty area that's a half mile from the beach. And this is very much the kind of place I lived in as a kid. And from here, it seems like now that I'm here, it seems like I've been here forever. And I think about St. Louis and it seems like, did I really live in a city and in the Central West End in this huge rambling house? It seems like a weird story that happened to somebody else, which maybe just means I adapt pretty quickly to wherever I am. I don't know. A lot of meaningful chapters in my life. And now, yeah, now coming back to this place, and which is both a return in some ways to what's familiar, but what's new about it is I'm here with a partner who is from Missouri, raised there. And so it's sort of watching him discover this place that I've called home for a long time. So that makes it new to me in some way.
Do you feel any difference in your work since you've moved?
No, but I think it's too soon to tell. No, I mean, what I've always required is quiet and a view of some trees. And in St. Louis, I was actually, even though I was in the Central West End, able to find a quiet place that had a lot of trees.
Yeah, you've talked about past collections being inspired by walks you took with your dog in Forest Park and at the Missouri Botanical Garden. I guess, for one thing, you need to find some new walks to take.
I know. And here, the equivalent of that is going to the beach every day. The problem is you can't bring the dog to the beach during the summer. But we'll soon be at September 1st, and then dogs are allowed to run on the beach. And what there is now down the road, there's some kind of a park. I don't know what it's supposed to be for, but I take the dog there every day and walk her around. So it's not Forest Park, but it's still nice.
Well, you talked about, when you were here, you talked about missing the ocean. When did you first lay eyes on the ocean again when you moved back?
Oh, well, as soon as I got here. I mean, I make a point of seeing the ocean every day. And it's kind of, even if you don't make a point of it, if you just go to the supermarket or something, you're going to see it or see a road that leads to it. This next one is called Like So. From attention to adoration is a smallish distance. And yet no arrow, no boat with sail can cross it, like the mind's insistence. We'd reached the marshes by then that all the dead must come to. I could see my face tilted there like a solar eclipse viewed indirectly, which is the proper way in a basin of water. You must hold it steady, keep the basin safe from the wind's reach, its competing powers of revelation and distortion.
What's happening in Like So that interests you?
I like that it's in two parts and that the first part rhymes, the distance and insistence. And I don't know, I've always liked this poem because it's it almost seems like two parts that shouldn't go together in the same poem. They should be separate poems. And as soon as I put them together, they seem like they spoke to each other in interesting ways to me. And I guess I'm interested most in how it ends, it talks about the wind's powers of revelation and distortion. And I think that's a big theme in the book when we talk about memory and how, when is memory a revelation of the truth and when is it a distortion of the truth? And that question doesn't get answered, but it gets mulled over, I think, in many of the other poems in the book.
And I think the science behind memory is less that a memory exists on an island in our brain somewhere that we occasionally have access to, but rather that we're essentially recreating it every time mm-hmm. we think of it, in a sense.
That's right. That's right. And a lot of the recreating has to do with what is convenient. You know, we often remember a thing in a certain way because we need to. You know, we're not going to remember that we were cruel to somebody. Instead, we are more likely to remember it as, oh, this person made me have to behave in a certain way because that makes us look better, rather than saying something like, oh, perhaps I was cruel.
Well, thinking about memory, you've also said with respect to the new work that it deals with releasing ourselves from the need to understand our past. Is that a fool's errand? Is there understanding to be found in our memories?
I think what interests me is, I feel as if we're programmed, or I anyway was raised to think that the past is something that can be understood and you should want to understand it because then you'll know more about the present. But I think as I've gotten older, it feels like maybe we can't always make sense of the past. Some things just happened and things played out the way they did and it doesn't have to mean anything. But I think it's hard, for me, it has been hard to get to that point of accepting that it doesn't have to mean anything, because I think I'm kind of a philosophical poet. I like to understand big things in life, like the past. But it does feel like a release if you can let go and say, well, that just happened. I don't need to punish myself for it, nor do I have to, you know, be overly proud of the past. Things just happen the way they happened. And I guess I feel like you can't escape the past at the same time. So it's still there, but maybe it's about, I find as I get older, it's about establishing a relationship with the past that's manageable, as opposed to having to resolve it. It's kind of how I feel about demons in general, like whatever our private demons are. I don't think there's no conquering those things. There's just trying to figure out, how can you move forward knowing this is part of who you are?
I guess we can't conquer the past, but maybe we can establish a truce with it.
Yeah. An unsteady truce, but yeah, we can try.
This episode was produced and engineered by Jeremy Goodwin, with podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.